Tango Tango Papa 1585, October 18, 2011.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Franklin, Kentucky. I unloaded this morning over in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and then, when I first got up, I got up about, I don't know, it was about 7:20 or something is what I have my alarm set for. And I noticed that there was a message on my Qualcomm saying, hey, we have this, the night people had sent it, the night dispatchers had sent this message, as a load offer, and then a message in a load offer. It was a load that was supposed to pick up in somewhere, I don't remember now, without looking, and it was the load was going to the Bronx, New York City, and it was gonna, it was one of these just-in-time loads that there was just not really, they're not really allowing enough time for it to get there, so that, it had to be picked up at, sometime late this afternoon, and then it was, whoever picked it up was going to have to drop it at Allentown, because we have a little yard there in Allentown, a little company yard, and then they have a local driver that actually, or a regional driver that actually would take it from the company yard in Allentown and deliver it into New York City. And so, but I just ignored that load. Even though I don't want to go to New York City, and I wouldn't have to, but it was just too tight. They were trying to push too many miles in too small of a time frame, and so it just didn't work. And so I didn't even answer the message. And apparently the night guy, as they often do, they'll fish for they'll send messages to different trucks, sort of fishing for somebody that's going to answer. And, so I just didn't answer that. And then whenever I did send, got unloaded and sent the empty message, I guess it was about 10 a.m. this morning, Central Time, they sent a message back saying, well, we don't really have any loads right now. Go to a nearby truck stop and hang out and wait. So that's what I did. I went back. There's a Flying J truck stop about 9 miles from where I unloaded at Oak Grove, Kentucky, along Interstate 24, and so I went back over there, and then I, ate lunch and kind of hung out there for several hours. So then, meanwhile, this afternoon they sent a load that, a load offer that picks up Tuesday morning at Scottsville, Kentucky. And it delivers several days from now in Mira Loma, California, which is Southern California, basically. Near Ontario. So, anyway, that's what I'm doing. So I came over here. There's a Flying J truck stop here at Franklin, Kentucky, and so that's where I'm spending the night at. And I, I'll get up in the morning and pick the load up tomorrow morning. It's got a 10 a.m. appointment time, so I'll leave here in time to get up, I think it's maybe I'll allow at least probably an hour to drive there. I think the GPS is kind of suggesting, maybe 30 minutes or something. So I'll try to get there about at least an hour early as well. So I'll probably try to leave here maybe by around 8 a.m., so I can get there, and I don't know if that I can't. I've p- picked the load up at that place before, but I can't remember if it was a drop and hook or if it was a live load. I just can't remember. But I know, I'm pretty sure I have picked loads up there before, but I just don't remember anything about it. So, anyway, before I go on too long, I want to talk about GoToMeeting. Today, with everyone working on the go, holding an impromptu meeting can be almost impossible. Not anymore with GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can host your meeting online from your computer while your attendees join from any computer or an iPad. And now from an iPhone or any Android mobile device too. With the free GoToMeeting app, anyone can attend your online meeting sessions. They just tap the email invitation and they'll instantly join. It's that easy. The new GoToMeeting app basically is pretty amazing. You can see the host's desktop right from your smartphone or your tablet. You can attend meetings on the go while, you know, you could be in a taxi, for example, waiting in an airport, wherever. So GoToMeeting will change the way you work. You can try GoToMeeting free today. Go to the App Store or the Android Market to download the free app and start joining GoToMeeting sessions from anywhere. And host your own meetings with a free 30-day trial. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button. Then you use the promo code PODCAST. So you go to GoToMeeting.com, you click on the Try It Free button, and you use the promo code PODCAST. And so that kind of takes care of that. So, because I have a tendency to forget. So, you know, it's amazing what we can do today with, you know, these mobile devices. And I was listening, you know, one of the podcasts that I subscribe to is Twit. And I'm, you know, I don't listen to every episode. I listen to, you know, it depends on who the guests are. Because sometimes Leo Laporte will have, you know, just kind of a bunch of silly guests on, and they don't even really talk tech, and it just, you know, it turns into a silly fest. And in those cases, there are times when I'll start to listen to one of those episodes that's like that, and I just turn it off, you know. And that's the beauty of podcasts. That's one of the beauty of podcasts, listening. So in any case, this one that I was listening to earlier, and I'm still got most, you know, a good chunk of the episode left, probably at least half of it left to listen to when I start listening again. But he had John Dvorak, and he had the O'Malik on there, and Robert Scoble and several other people. And O'Malik was making some interesting points. You know, they were kind of saying, well, you know, they were talking about you know, Apple iPhone versus Google Android versus, you know, the other phone manufacturers, you know, or people that are trying to push different types of smartphones like BlackBerries and Nokia and Microsoft, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And O'Malik made a really good point, you know, because they were trying to say, oh, it's a war between Google and Apple. Well, no, it's not. O'Malik had a better way of looking at it, and here's why. It's, you know, Google and Apple are both successful with they really own the smartphone business, and then, you know, the other players are just kind of competing for a little tiny fraction of it. And the reason is because, you know, O'Malik said that, and I agree with him, that Apple iPhones as well as Google Android phones are they're sort of mobile web-centric devices, and so you're able to take, you know, different apps and what have you, and many of them are there's a lot of cross-platform apps that you know, in other words, there's versions for Android as well as you know, the iOS, so they're cross-platform, and they, you know, they work well, you know, either way. And I use a number of those, you know, Heytel's one of them, Words with Friends is another one. Of course, Facebook and, Foursquare and so on and so forth. All of those are completely cross-platform. We'll work on, but Google and Apple have done a pretty good job of bringing certain parts of the web into the mobile space, and people are kind of carrying that around with them. They're kind of carrying the best parts of the web around with them, and they make it mobile. Whereas, Microsoft and absolutely BlackBerry and RIM, or I'm sorry, the RIM BlackBerry and Nokia are, those are more about phone-centric devices. Certainly the BlackBerry is that way. It's all about the phone, and you get little bits and pieces of the web that you can get at through that, this clunky phone that doesn't seem to, they've had some massive problems lately, doesn't seem to work right lately. I guess they got the problem solved, and I'm not even sure that they knew what happened. There was probably a cyber attack, and they're just not going to say. But, apparently it was offline for about 3 days, and it really disrupted people that still have BlackBerries. So, and it'll probably end up accelerating the demise of BlackBerry. But the problem with BlackBerry is that it's a phone-centric device. It's not about applications, and it's not centered about applications in the web. And so that's why, in O'Malley's view, that's why the Apple iPhone is so popular. As well as why there's being so many Android phones, why that's such a popular platform for phones. And it's just Android is has the biggest market share at this point. Of course, it's not a single device. It's Android is the operating system, and there's quite a few different devices. Versus Apple has about 30% of the smartphone market, but those are all Apple. Obviously Apple. Operating system Apple devices. So, but that's the reason. It's because Apple and Google are doing a better job of sort of bringing this mobile web app type experience. The certain types of content that people want from the internet, they're doing a better job of bringing that to mobile devices that people can carry around with them and make it useful. And the other phone manufacturers are just they're making it too much about the phone and not really concentrating on the content. So, but I thought that was a good observation, and it's not really so much a war between Apple and Google. What they really have to do, the moral of the story is whoever can do a better job of bringing the content to the mobile experience, to the mobile smartphone, you bring the right content to it, and then it's not really so much about the phone. It's about getting at the content, that's really what's driving the success for both Apple and Google. So, now I did see that, I was kind of reading through some articles this evening while I was eating, and they're saying now that that Sprint has the iPhone, that Sprint actually has signed up a lot of new customers for the first time in a long time, which I'm glad to see that. So I'm sure Sprint, I don't know if that, originally 4 years ago when before the iPhone came out, I don't know how many companies Apple actually shopped. I'm sure they talked to several different companies. And then AT&T was the one that ended up doing business with them. And I think some of the other ones just... snubbed their noses at Apple, maybe. I'm not sure. Be an interesting thing to go back and research, what the real history of that was. you know, if it's available. I don't even know that, you know, that it's available. I'm sure it will be. If it's not, it will be at some point. But, you know, AT&T really did itself a favor by making the exclusive deal with Apple 4 years ago with the original iPhone. And but now, of course, Verizon has it, and then now Sprint has it as well as AT&T. And so that's, you know, I'm glad to see that. I want Sprint to be able to survive. Obviously, even if they didn't, we're still all going to have cell phones, and you just, you know, I want there to be more than two carriers. You know, I want there to be more than three carriers. I hope that T-Mobile is able to survive, you know. So, but I'm glad to see that Sprint, you know, at least with, you know, them getting the iPhone on the Sprint network is generating now some genuine excitement among, you know, and new customers for Sprint. So, anyway, I have, I recorded, you know, you've heard me talk about this. There's this book, it's called, and it was written about 100 years ago. The name of it is The Crowd, and it's by the author's name. He was a Frenchman, Gustave Le Bon, and he wrote a number of books. This is probably his most famous book, and, this book, it, you know, he really goes into, you know, he talks about basically mob psychology and the psychology of kind of controlling groups of people. Basically, it's sort of like, you know, I'm going to use my words, kind of taking control of the groupthink, you know, is basically what he's, you know, if I'm going to use my words, that's how what I would say. It's a method of he discusses methodologies, and he's talking about groupthink. You know, he called it by different names, but it's basically groupthink and how you can take control of it. And his observations that he was making are very valid. Right up into this day, it doesn't matter that it was written 100 years ago. It's very, you know, just extremely valid. And you know, it's up to you as a reader. It's left up to the reader to be able to recognize what the guy's saying. You know, be able to recognize. You know, you have to be able to recognize the truth. And but anyway, I read part of one chapter. You know, made a recording, and it goes on for about 33 minutes. So I'm going to play that here in a bit and give you a flavor for what this book is. And this book is in public domain. It was written 100 years ago. It's called The Crowd, Study the Popular Mind is the subtitle. And that's, just look that up in Google. You can easily find it in EPUB format and probably a number of other formats as well. And it is well worth taking the time to read it. It really is, because if you really can understand what he's saying, it's kind of startling. You know, you should. You know, people just don't realize how many people there are around us. We don't really realize. How many people around us are programmed? They're not genuine people with genuine identities. They're programmed animals, basically. And, you know, they may be programmed and to be nice, and, you know, and they seem nice, and those people, you know, they're, in other words, they're slaves. They're slaves of their environment, to different elements in their environment. You know, when you're a slave, you know, you're in denial, and you have this ability to, you know, and it's actually quite a remarkable thing. You've got this remarkable ability, you know, kind of in a negative sense, to not see, even when someone has directly pressured you, you've got this remarkable ability to not, you know, to just absolutely not be willing to admit to yourself, to not see that you acted out of someone else's pressure, that you responded to whatever the strongest pressure was. And, you know, I've seen that happen to me, you know, in the past. I know that that can happen, and it can be a painful thing to, you know, to admit to yourself that someone else controlled you. And it's a very hard thing for, you know, most people, you know, there's a lot of people that would rather be dead than admit that something like that happened to them. And I mean literally, they would rather be dead than ever admit to themselves that someone else had control of them. They'd rather be dead than admit that they're wrong. So, but there, you know, there's just tons of people around us that are programmed. And the problem is, it's easy to screw people up. You know, it's very easy to screw people up. You can't, you know, trying to program people to do the right thing, that doesn't work. You know, there are always people that think, oh, well, we'll just reprogram these people and make them do the right thing. That doesn't work, I'm sorry. You know, it just doesn't produce the results you want. And so, you know, basically you can tweak the laws, try to change laws, change this, change that, all day long, and it's not going to do you any good. Because if you have too many people, if you have too high of a percentage of, you can almost think of it as background noise. If the background noise of, you know, kind of people that are just programmed is too high versus the number of people with genuine identities, then, you know, that are able to actually reason. If the signal to noise ratio is too high, you got a real problem. You know, you're just dealing with human mush. You're dealing with programmed people, and people will just, you know, people pick up the programming from their environment. They're externalized, and you can try changing laws all day long, and you know, people will just ignore the laws. So it's I don't know. It's but. As I say, we just don't realize how many people are like that. And, you know, so this book is really quite an eye-opener. You know, it's... Now, you know, and I mentioned here in the file that I'm going to play here in a second, this was written about 100 years ago, and the guy is using, you know, it's a Frenchman, and this is obviously translated into English. And he's using a little bit more flowery language than what we're probably used to reading today. You know, and it's parts of the language. It's understandable. It's eminently understandable. But parts of it are a little bit dense. Now, before I play the file, the other thing I wanted to talk about... you know, for a long time I've had this dilemma. What, you know, because warning people about things, facing reality. I'm going to sneeze here. Here. that was satisfying. Warning people about things, you know, because you can all, I don't know, I've always been able to kind of see things coming, you know, maybe see things from a long ways away coming. And, you know, they're getting closer. But I've had this dilemma. You know, I feel like I got to warn people, or I want to face reality myself. But then then there's this dilemma. Well, you know, it's just what do you want? You just want doom and gloom, and you're just going to preach doom and gloom, and you know, are you happy about the doom and gloom? Or are you, you know, what are you going to do if the doom and gloom doesn't come? Or what are you going to do if it does come? So that's a dilemma for a lot of people, that especially people that face reality. It's a real dilemma, and I finally come to the conclusion that I still have to face reality. You know, I can't just stick my head in the sand and pretend like nothing's happening and, you know, just, you know, everything's going to work out. Everything's going to be wonderful and just watch, you know, play with my little electronic goodies and, you know, and lose myself in some interesting entertainment and, you know, eat a bunch of food and, you know, just kind of, you know, forget it. I can't do that. I have to face reality. I want to face reality. I want to know the truth, wherever the truth is, wherever it leads. That's what I want. I'm driven to do that. And that truth can be harsh, especially if you know, if you've lived your life in denial. The truth can be a harsh thing. It can be painful if you've you spent too much time running away from it. So what is the point? Really, what is the point then? So the point is that I've come to, you know, you should face reality, but, you know, and this applies just to even to me as well. You know, I don't know when it's going to happen, but I see some really bad things on the horizon. Really negative things on the horizon. Now, I think here's what the conclusion that I've come to. Regardless of what happens, and I mean regardless of what happens, how shocking it is, the message is, you know, face reality, but don't resent it. No matter what it is, no matter how horrible, don't resent what you see, you know, what happens. Don't resent it. You know, and that's really the message, and you know, kind of being able to see what's coming, and telling other people about it, the real message should be, and don't resent it. Don't be upset by it. You know it's coming. It's going to come. You know it's on its way. And it's going to be very tempting for a lot of people to resent what they see or you know, whatever it is that happens, the negative things that happen. And so, you know, the thing is, don't resent it. And so that's really, you know, the conclusion that I've come to is, you know, I'm still gonna, you know, I want to face reality, but it's not just to be gloom and doom or to, you know, to rain on other people's parade. Really, I should be adding, and don't resent it. Don't resent what you see. It, but you know, I'm just warning you. I'm giving you the information here. It's coming, and here's why. And you know, and oftentimes it's really useful to be able to see and explain why something's going to happen or why something is the way it is, why people are the way they are. And that's not really a negative thing. It's really you got to be able to know what's wrong. If you're, you know, for example, if your car won't run or it's got a miss in it, then you take it to a mechanic and find out, well, hey, you know, it's got this problem or it's got that problem. In the case of my pickup, they needed to replace a coil and a spark plug, and that fixed the problem. That's what I wanted. You know, I didn't want to just polish on the pickup and say, "Oh well, it the engine misses, but it looks good as long as I polish and clean on it. It really looks good, and then I can just kind of pretend like that miss isn't there in the engine." You know, that's ridiculous. But yet, when it comes to the way our minds work and how we live our lives, we do the equivalent of that. We kind of try to pretend like there's nothing wrong, and you know, kind of, oh well, let's concentrate on the positive things, and you know, forget about the negative things. Let's bury our heads in the sand. Can't do that. And so, but the thing is, you got to know it's coming, but don't resent it. And if you don't resent it, an interesting thing happens. It can't, you may be affected by it, but it can't, as I've said before, no matter what happens to me, as long as I don't resent it, whatever it is that happens, cannot disrupt the bond that I have with my Creator. And that's really about the best way that I can say it. And, you know, so it can't, in other words, it can't disrupt the relationship, the bond that I have with the source of my identity. So, in other words, my identity, as long as I don't resent, my identity cannot be shaken. Regardless of what happens to me, it can happen to me directly. My identity cannot, the bond that I have with the source of my identity cannot be disrupted. So that's really about the best way that I can say it. And of course, if you don't, if you're kind of on the outside looking in, it may sound like I'm just talking gobbledygook. And I assure you I'm not. And my hope is that everyone that listens to me would be able to find this relationship for themselves. You know, because it's really, I think that's why we're here, is it to, you know, to develop this relationship, you know, to develop the right kind of identity. It's all about identity. It's not about religion. It's not about, preachers and churches and so on and so forth. It's very simple. It's about, you know, the whole point of existence is, you know, and is the whole point is to find your identity. Somehow find your genuine identity. You know, find the, you know, bond to the source of that. That's why we're here. So, anyway, let me go ahead and play this file. It's about 33 minutes and 46 seconds. And this is me reading from... The name of the book is The Crowd by Gustav Le Bon. Okay, I'm going to be reading from... It's a book. It was written about 100 years ago. The name of it, I've talked about it before. It's The Crowd, Study of the Popular Mind. The author was a Frenchman by the name of Gustav Le Bon. And this is this book is really... I guess they'd say seminal. It is really the seminal early book about crowds and sort of, you know, crowd control. He talks about the ideas that, you know, how ideas are contagious and so on and so forth. How we'd say today, oh, things are going viral. he was talking about these things. So, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and I'm not sure. This just the title for this particular part that I'm going to read is The Means of Action of the Leader's Affirmation, Repetition, and Contagion. So, he's basically saying the means of action of the leaders, and those three things are affirmation, repetition, and contagion. Now, this language is a little bit flowery. Some of it is, not all of it is, but some of it is. And, I think our standards have probably changed. And this was originally obviously written in French, I think, and then translated into English. But it's pretty clear for the most part. There are parts of it that are a little bit dense. But anyway, I'll go ahead and read this. When it is wanted to stir up a crowd for a short space of time, to induce it to commit an act of any nature, to pillage a palace, or to die in defense of a stronghold or a barricade, for instance, the crowd must be acted upon by rapid suggestion, among which example is the most powerful in its effect. To attain this end, however, it is necessary that the crowd should have been previously prepared by certain circumstances and above all, that he who wishes to work upon it should possess the quality to be studied farther on, to which I give the name of prestige. When, however, it is proposed to imbue the mind of a crowd with ideas and beliefs, in other words, to introduce an idea into the mind of the crowd, with modern social theories, for instance, the leaders have recourse to different expedients. The principal of them are three in number and clearly defined: affirmation, repetition, and contagion. Their action is somewhat slow, but its effects, once produced, are very lasting. Affirmation, pure and simple, kept free of all reasoning and all proof, is one of the surest means of making an idea enter the minds of crowds. The conciser an affirmation is, the more destitute of every appearance of proof and demonstration, the more weight it carries. The religious books and legal codes of all ages have always resorted to simple affirmation. Statesmen called upon to defend a political cause, and commercial men pushing the sale of their products by means of advertising, are acquainted with the value of affirmation. Affirmation, however, has no real influence unless it be consistent or constantly repeated, and so far as possible in the same terms. It was Napoleon, I believe, who said that there was only one figure in rhetoric of serious importance, namely repetition. The thing affirmed comes by repetition to fix itself in the mind in such a way that it is accepted in the end and as a demonstrated truth. The influence of repetition on crowds is comprehensible when the power is seen which it exercises on the most enlightened minds. The power is due to the fact that the repeated statement is embedded in the long run in those profound regions of our unconscious selves in which the motives of our actions are forged. At the end of a certain time, we have forgotten who is the author of the repeated assertion, and we finish by believing it. To this circumstance is due the astonishing power of advertisements. When we have read 100,000 times that X's chocolate is the best, we imagine we have heard it said in many quarters, and we end by acquiring the certitude that such is the fact. When we have read 1,000 times that wise flour has cured the most illustrious persons of the most obstinate maladies, we are tempted at last to try it when suffering from an illness of a similar kind. If we always read in the same papers that A is an arrant scamp and B is a most honest man, we finish by being convinced that this is the truth, unless indeed we are given to reading another paper of the contrary opinion, in which the two qualifications are reversed. Affirmation and repetition are alone powerful enough to combat each other. When an affirmation has been sufficiently repeated and there is unanimity in the repetition, as has occurred in a case of certain famous financial undertakings rich enough to purchase every assistance, what is called a current of opinion is formed, and the powerful mechanism of contagion intervenes. Ideas, sentiments, emotions, and beliefs possess in crowds a contagious power as intense as that of microbes. This phenomena is very natural, since it is observed even in animals when they are together in number. Should a horse in a stable take to biting his manger, the other horses in the stable will imitate him. A panic that has seized a few sheep will soon extend to the whole flock. In the case of men collected in a crowd, all emotions are very rapidly contagious, which explains the suddenness of panics. Brain disorders, like madness, are themselves contagious. The frequency of madness among doctors who are specialists for the mad is notorious. Indeed, forms of madness have recently been cited, agoraphobia, for instance, which are communicable from men to animals. Now, agoraphobia, I think that's where you have a agoraphobia, if I'm not mistaken, is where you kind of fear leaving your house. And I don't know where he's getting this communicable from men to animals. That might be an interesting little thing to follow up on. You got to remember this was written 100 years ago. For individuals to succumb to contagion, their simultaneous presence on the same spot is not indispensable. The action of contagion may be felt from a distance under the influence of events which give all minds an individual trend and the characteristics peculiar to crowds. This is especially the case when men's minds have been prepared to undergo the influence in question by those remote factors of which I have made a study above. An example in point is the revolutionary movement of 1848, which, after breaking out in Paris, spread rapidly over a great part of Europe and shook a number of thrones. Imitation, to which so much influence is attributed in social phenomena, is in reality a mere effect of contagion, having shown its influence elsewhere. I shall confine myself to reproducing what I said on the subject 15 years ago. My remarks have since been developed by other writers in recent publications. And he's quoting himself, "Man, like animals, has a natural tendency to imitation. Imitation is a necessity for him, provided always that imitation is quite easy. It is this necessity that makes the influence of what is called fashion so powerful. Whether in the matter of opinions, ideas, literary manifestations, or merely of dress, how many persons are bold enough to run counter to the fashion? It is by examples, not by arguments, that crowds are guided. At every period, there exists a small number of individualities which react upon the remainder and are imitated by the unconscious mass. It is needful, however, that these individualities should not be too pronounced disagreement with received ideas. Were they so, to imitate them would be difficult, and their influence would be nil. For this very reason, men who are too superior to their epoch are generally without influence upon it. The line of separation is too strongly marked. For the same reason, too, Europeans, in spite of all the advantages of their civilization, have so insignificant an influence on Eastern people. They differ from them too great an extent. The dual action of the past and of reciprocal imitation renders, in the long run, all men of the same country and the same period so alike that even in the case of individuals who would seem destined to escape this double influence, such as philosophers, learned men, and men of letters, thought and style have a family air which enables the age to which they belong to be immediately recognized. It is not necessary to talk for long with an individual to attain a thorough knowledge of what he reads, of his habitual occupations, and of the surroundings amid which he lives." And that he had written that in, I believe, 1881. Let's see. "Contagion is so powerful that it forces upon individuals not only certain opinions, but certain modes of feeling as well. Contagion is the cause of the contempt in which, at a given period, certain works are held. For example, Tannhauser may be cited, which a few years later, for the same reason, was admired by those who were foremost in criticizing them. The opinions and beliefs of crowds are especially propagated by contagion, but never by reasoning. The conceptions at present rife among the working classes have been acquired at the public house as a result of affirmation, repetition, and contagion, and indeed the mode of creation of the beliefs of crowds of every age has scarcely been different. Renan justly institutes a comparison between the first founders of Christianity and the socialist working men spreading their ideas from public house to public house. While Voltaire had already observed, in connection with Christian religion, that for more than 100 years it was only embraced by the vilest riffraff. It would be noted, it will be noted rather, that the in cases of analogous to those I have just cited, contagion, after having been at work among the popular classes, has spread to the higher classes of society. This is what we see happening at present day with regards to the socialist doctrines, which are beginning to be held by those who will yet be their first victims. Contagion is so powerful a force that even the sentiment of personal interest disappears under its action. This is the explanation of the fact that every opinion adopted by the populace always ends in implanting itself with great vigor in the highest social strata, however obvious be the absurdity of the triumphant opinion. This reaction of lower upon higher social classes is the more curious owing to the circumstances that the beliefs of the crowds always have their origin to a greater or less extent in some higher idea, which has often remained without influence in the sphere in which it was evolved. Leaders and agitators, subjugated by this higher idea, take hold of it, distort it, and create a sect which distorts it all afresh, and then propagates it amongst the masses, who carry the process of deformation still further, become a popular truth. The idea returns, as it were, to its source and exerts an influence on the upper classes of a nation. In the long run, it is intelligence that shapes the destiny of the world, but very indirectly. The philosophers who have evolved, who evolve ideas, have long since returned to dust, when, as the result of the processes I have just described, the fruit of their reflection ends by triumphing. Prestige. Great power is given to ideas propagated by affirmation, repetition, and contagion by the circumstances that they acquire in time that mysterious force known as prestige. Whatever has been a ruling power in the world, whether it be ideas or men, has in the main enforced its authority by means of that irresistible force expressed by the word prestige. The term is one whose meaning is grasped by everybody, but the word is employed in ways too different for it to be easy to define it. Prestige may involve such sentiments as admiration or fear. So both of those, admiration or fear. Occasionally, even these sentiments are its basis, but it can perfectly well exist without them. The greatest measure of prestige is possessed by the dead, by beings, that is, of whom we do not stand in fear, by Alexander, Caesar, Mahomet, and Buddha, for example. On the other hand, there are fictive beings whom we do not admire, the monstrous divinities of the subterranean temples of India, for instance, but who strike us nevertheless as endowed with great prestige. Prestige in reality is a sort of domination exercised on our mind by an individual, a work, or an idea. This domination entirely paralyzes our critical faculty and fills our soul with astonishment and respect. The sentiment provoked in this is inexplicable, like all sentiments, but it would appear to be the same kind as the fascination to which a magnetized person is subjected. Prestige is the mainspring of all authority. Neither gods, kings, nor women have ever cringed, or reigned, rather, without it. The various kinds of prestige may be grouped under two principal heads: acquired prestige and personal prestige. Acquired prestige is that resulting from name, fortune, and reputation. It may be independent of personal prestige. Personal prestige, on the contrary, is something essentially peculiar to the individual. It may coexist with reputation, glory, and fortune, or be strengthened by them, but it is perfectly capable of existing in their absence. Acquired or artificial prestige is the most common. The mere fact that an individual occupies a certain position, possesses a certain fortune, or bears certain titles endows him with prestige, however slight his own personal worth. A soldier in uniform, a judge in his robes, always enjoys prestige. Pascal has very properly noted the necessity for judges of robes and wigs. Without them, they would be stripped of half of their authority. The most unbending socialist is always somewhat impressed by the sight of a prince or a marquis, and the assumption of such titles makes the robbing of tradesmen an easy matter. The influence of titles, decorations, and uniforms on crowds is to be traced in all countries, even those in which the sentiment of personal independence is the most strongly developed. I quote in this connection a curious passage from a recent book of travel on the prestige enjoyed by England by great persons. Quote, "I had observed under various circumstances the peculiar sort of intoxication produced by the most reasonable Englishman by the contact or sight of an English peer, provided his fortune enables him to keep his rank, he is sure of their affection in advance, and brought into contact with him, they are so enchanted as to put up with anything at his hands. They may be seen to redden with pleasure at his approach, and if he speaks to them, their suppressed joy increases their redness and causes their eyes to gleam with unusual brilliance. Respect for nobility is in their blood, so to speak, as with Spaniards the love of dancing, with Germans that of music, and with Frenchmen the liking for revolutions. Their passion for horses and Shakespeare is less violent. The satisfaction and pride they derive from these sources of sources a less integral part of their being. There is considerable sale for books dealing with the peerage, and go where one will, they are to be found, like the Bible, in all hands." Unquote. The prestige of which I have just spoken is exercised by persons side by side with it may be placed that exercised by opinions, literary, and artistic works. The prestige of the latter kind is most often merely the result of accumulated repetitions, history, literary, and artistic history especially, being nothing more than the repetition of identical judgments which nobody endeavors to verify. Everyone ends by repeating that or what he learned at school, there till there come to be names and things which nobody would venture to meddle with. For a modern reader of or the perusal of Homer results incontestably in immense boredom, but who would venture to say so? The Parthenon, in its present state, is a wretched ruin, utterly destitute of interest, but it is endowed with such prestige that it does not appear to us as it really is, but with all its accompaniment of historic memories. The special characteristic of prestige is to prevent us seeing things as they are and to entirely paralyze our judgment. Crowds always, and individuals as a rule, stand in need of ready-made opinions on all subjects. The popularity of these opinions is independent of the measure of truth or error they contain and is solely regulated by their prestige. Now, I think I'm going to stop there. This book, well, yeah, this kind of goes on. I think I'm going to stop, and if I haven't enticed you to, you know, you can get this book. I downloaded it. You know, this is written 100 years ago, and it's completely public domain. You can get it in like an EPUB format, readily available. It's just The Crowd, Study the Popular Mind by Gustav Le Bon. And if you just type in The Crowd, Study of the Popular Mind, it'll pop up, and you can. But, you know, I've got it on my Nook, and, you know, a lot of different devices will read the EPUB format, including, obviously, your computer will. But this is, you know, this is just chock full. What, you know, what he's observing here what we know about the brain today that they didn't know back then. He was simply observing behavior, and what we know today, we know a whole lot more about the brain, and things like mirror neurons and so on and so forth. But what he really doesn't go into, he's just sort of observing people. But I contend that individual people, or certainly groups of people, but even individual people, have some sort of a suggestibility quotient. So in other words, to varying degrees, people are actually suggestible. And there has to be a way of measuring that, coming up with a way of measuring the suggestibility of someone, or, and then in aggregate, a group of people. But if you're suggestible, the more suggestible you are, the more subject you are to the things that this guy's talking about. And what makes you more suggestible is basically, it revolves around resentment and whether you're willing to look at your own resentment or not. Because we start out, we have resentment, we get it as a little kid, and then we make the mistake of resenting as a little kid, and then it begins to snowball, and that's our reaction, and then everything keeps reinforcing that existing resentment. We may have completely since forgotten whatever it was, the original thing we got upset with, and resentment style upset, and then it gets to the point where, some people actually literally are afraid to leave their house, because every little thing can they become more and more and more sensitive to their environment. And as human beings, we're not supposed to be sensitive to our environment in that way. Our environment, we're not supposed to take our identity from our environment. Our core identity should not come from our environment. That's inferior. Animals do that. And human beings, if we're not careful, we can devolve in our own lifetime. We're the only creatures on this planet that I believe that we can actually evolve or devolve as an individual within our own lifetime. So, let alone society at large. So I contend that resentment makes us suggestible. And then, of course, you throw pride in there. The only option you have is to become proud of what you resented, proud of where resentment has taken you, proud of the externalized identity that resentment implants in you, and then you just become worse, you become more and more externalized, more increasingly sensitive to the world around you, increasingly sensitive to your environment, and then therefore motivated by your environment. And in such a state, you're not a real person. You may think you are. You may think you're a real person with a real identity, and all you are is you're just a robot. You're just programmed. And you have no genuine identity. You're separated from it. And so people that know these things, that know how to manipulate, it's almost like you got a pan with a handle. They know how to manipulate your handle. Then it becomes very easy to, kind of get you to do this, get you to do that, and all these different things will work on you. What he's talking about, the advertising, affirmation, and then repetition, so on and so forth. That will work on you. It really will. So it's all about your resentment, and you know, and it's all about, in the end, it's all about whether or not you're willing to look at yourself. And if too many people in a society won't look at themselves, then they're easily manipulated. And as knowledge, the only thing that's really gets better is knowledge. And of course, people are studying this stuff. And today we have people that would love nothing more than, you know, if the world plunged into a brand new dark age, they'd love nothing more than to basically, you know, you'd have a scientifically imposed bully state. Because that's basically what we're talking about, you know, strong before the weak, weak before the strong. And, you know, the dark ages, you had a bunch of people that were just kind of subjugated and, you know, sort of lived in poverty or lived off the land, the so-called peasants. And then you had the king at the top, and then a few people around him and, you know, around the king and the queen or whatever. And you had, and they basically just kind of, you know, it was a kind of a dog-eat-dog system with a lot of people on the bottom. And that's the kind of system that always evolves. And it doesn't matter how good the knowledge gets or how good our technology gets, that's the kind of system that happens. And so, you end up with a caste system, C-A-S-T-E, of one form or another, and that's always where it goes. And then, of course, the ultimate thing that would happen if it runs its course and God didn't intervene in it, there would be no human beings left, because ultimately the one that dominates is gonna try to kill the other people, and so there'd be nobody left. We'd go extinct. So, anyway, I wanted to read that, and this book, as I say, is free. It's out there on the internet. It is the crowd study, the popular or study of what is it? Study of the popular mind. Let me turn that back on so I can tell you the name of it. Yeah, the crowd study of the popular mind is the name of the book. Gustav Le Bon, and highly recommend it. I'm still kind of reading this. I read a little bit of it here and there. I might read several pages sometimes I read some of it when I go to bed, and then other times I'll, like I did tonight, I took it in a restaurant with me and I read it while I was eating, read part of it. And as I say, he's right on the money with a lot of this stuff. And the language can get a little bit flowery, and it's a little bit not really the style that we're used to today, but nonetheless, it's still very understandable and very worthwhile to read.
Okay, so there was me reading from the book called The Crowd, Study of the Popular Mind by Gustav Le Bon, written about 100 years ago. Now, one of the points that I read there, where he was talking about prestige, and he said that could either be, because normally I think what we think of today as prestige is, you know, like someone that's sort of elevated, or, you know, a lot of people look up to them for whatever reason, and prestige is more of a positive thing. At least that's the image I think we have in our minds. He was using that also in terms, and it also works in terms of someone you're afraid of. So, in other words, you know, Saddam Hussein, for example, you could say that when Saddam Hussein was the dictator of Iraq, that there were a lot of people that did look up to him, but there were also people that feared him. And so, in other words, the way that works, if you fear something, you look up to it, whether you want to or not. If you, you know, and basically the reason that you fear something, fear is the flip side of resentment. And so if you resent something, you end up either going along to get along, or you rebel and you try to do the opposite.
But either way, you lose your identity to it. You end up taking on the identity of the thing that you resent, the nature of the thing that you resent. But so people that, you know, are upset with the dictator, that resent the dictator, end up fearing the dictator. And, you know, and then, of course, Saddam Hussein, you know, the other part of it, you know, dictators like Saddam Hussein, you know, if you just look up a picture of Saddam Hussein, and a lot of times you see him all dressed up, and he's got, you know, all these medals, you know, on his coat, and, you know, and if you look at these dictators, they always do that. And that part where he's talking about if the English judges didn't have their robes and their wigs, that they'd lose half of their authority, that is part of, dictators know this. They are very well aware of this, and so they try to put on the clothing that will evoke the response. And so that's, if you think about it, that applies to us as well. There is power in uniforms. You know, criminals react, as well as the general public, reacts to the policeman's uniform. You know, if policemen, I'd say at least half of the policeman's power is the uniform. And so half of the doctor's authority, you go to the doctor, half of his authority is the fact that he's got the right clothes on, the doctor clothes, or maybe the stethoscope around his neck, and then that somehow gives him legitimacy, him or her. And so these things are all around us. We may not realize it, but that affects us just as much. And so it's a very, very interesting book. And Gustav Le Bon, you know, his observations in this book are just right on the money. It's quite an amazing book, and I can't recommend it enough. So, anyway, probably better be cutting this off. See if I can get this uploaded and then get headed to bed. Hope everyone is having a great week so far. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.